Welcome to the Education and Empowerment Podcast. In this show, our hosts explore success and advancement through education by interviewing today's top leaders in the fields of education, business, and technology in order to provide insight into what it really takes to succeed. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com. All right, let's get into the show.
You're tuned to Education and Empowerment Podcast. This is your host, Bahtiyar Soyev, and today I will be interviewing Dr. Juan Stanji. Dr. Juan Stanji has over 35 years of experience as a student-centered housing professional. He has worked in public, private, mid-sized, and large institutions. Dr. Juan Stanji has nonetheless been plenty busy with associations' response to COVID-19. Dr. Juan Stanji is an experienced in crisis management, floods and tornado, occupancy management, creative solutions to more buddies than beds, the new construction of the building and built over 1,500 new beds in the past 5 years, and have worked on master lease agreements, external reviews, both on his campus and other campuses, writing publications in other areas. Dr. Juan Stanji also serves as an adjunct assistant professor in the University of Iowa's College of Education. In addition to oversight of housing and dining, Dr. Juan Stanji also oversees University of Iowa's counseling services, student health services, student wellness, recreational services, and the rape victim advocacy program. In this episode, Dr. Juan Stanji and I will be discussing the post-COVID future of on- and off-campus housing. Where do we go from here? We'll talk about the work Akuho I has and will impact student success outside of classroom. What are the major concerns of the Akuho I members at this point? And how does Akuho I react to resolving those that are coming in the future? All right, let's get started. Hello and welcome to the Education and Empowerment Podcast. This is your host, Bahtiyar Soyev, and today I'm joined by Dr. Juan Stanji. In this episode, Dr. Stanji and I will be exploring the topic of post-COVID future of on- and off-campus housing. And the question is, where do we go from here? So without further ado, Dr. Stanji, welcome to our show.
Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Amazing. We're excited to have you. It's such an amazing time right now, and there's so much discussion about what is the future like? Where do we go from here that we have experienced COVID and pandemia and all the changes that came to higher education and student housing? Before we even start, I wanted our audience to give them a better sense of who you are and what you do and how did you get into student housing and higher ed?
And it's a good question. I'm actually a first-generation college student, went to the University of South Dakota hoping to be a doctor. I really wasn't prepared in order to the academics. I kind of breezed through high school without really having to do a lot of studying. So the competitiveness of a pre-med program, in which it was the old saying of look to somebody to your left, look to the person to your right, one of you will not be here. And I was the person who was not going to be there by the time things got done. I lived on a farm growing up. And so the opportunity to go to living a community and establishing some new relationships and things like that was a great opportunity for me. Probably took a little too much advantage of those opportunities. More on that and less on studying. And so I learned that medicine was probably not in my future. But I enjoyed the involvements that I had while I was in college. I was hall council president. I was president of our Residence Hall Association. And as I got to my degree program, thought, well, I think it's time to go to graduate school. I thought I might be able to parlay my experience in the residence halls into a graduate assistantship or something along those lines. Graduate assistantships were few and far between, and academically, I probably didn't have the rigor in order to do that. So I actually got signed on as a full-time hall director of Texas Tech University while I worked on my master's part-time. for those people who are out there listening to this, I don't recommend that process. I really believe that I would have been a much better professional had I had the time to be a graduate assistant, been tutored and mentored a little bit more during that time. But it came out okay for me in the long run, I think. I think I just was probably a little slower on the uptake to get some of those experiences than others who had that tutelage during that time. So got my master's degree, went to Lehigh University for a couple of years where I served as an area coordinator. So I wanted to kind of the foray into the private experience after that. Well, during that time, I was married and we had a couple of kids and decided that we wanted to move back to somewhere where we were kind of in the middle in Pennsylvania, 14 hours from one set of grandparents, 14 hours from the other set of grandparents, thought that we'd like to be closer to one or the other. So a position opened up back at the University of South Dakota where I got my undergraduate and as an associate director, and I was selected for that position. So we moved back to South Dakota, spent 14 years there, and then during that time picked up my doctorate. And then as my kids were kind of in high school, another recommendation I may not make for other people to move their kids halfway through high school, found the job at the University of Iowa. And it was a perfect match. And I've been here ever since. So I think I'm in my 17th year at the University of Iowa as the director of housing and dining. And then during that time, I picked up some assistant vice president responsibilities and currently also oversee student health, student wellness, recreational services, and university counseling services. So it's been a good ride. I'm not regretful of anything that occurred along the way. And I continued my involvement just like I was as an undergraduate, continued those involvements professionally, which has kind of got me to where we are today.
That's amazing. And it sounds like you've lived it, what you do today. All those experiences make you a unique individual to hear from. I'm so excited to be speaking with you today. One of the things we're trying to explore on this podcast, on the Education Empowerment Podcast, is the whole notion of student success outside of classroom. And there is a belief that student housing and wellness and all of that directly contributes to the student's well-being. What would you say is your definition of student success outside of classroom? Like when you done all of those experiences, like what did you pursue? Like what was that vision of, I want to be in student housing or I want to be in student wellness and student affairs?
I think it really means that we're preparing our students for life after graduation. The classroom has provided them with the academic rigor that they need in order to be successful in their job. We're providing them the life skills and the support networks that are available to them to continue to work through any problems and opportunities they may have. And they have them during college, and they'll continue to have them after college as well. And we want them to learn about diversity, equity, and inclusion. We want them to learn to be resilient. We want them to learn to seek out support systems when we need them. And we want them to have a good sense of self and understand the importance of well-being. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later. We want people to give other people grace when they do or say something that they don't agree with. I think that's something that we're really struggling with in this country at this point in time. And we want them to be proud alumni of the University of Iowa and ultimately pay it forward with their time, talent, and treasure.
That's fantastic. I learned that the field can use a lot of advice and insights from individuals like yourself, like professionals like yourself. And I wanted to expand on your involvement with, if you don't mind sharing, how'd you get involved? And what did you do? And what's the impact of your work?
Sure. My involvement with Akuho Ai spans over 30 years. When I first got involved, I was first a professional. I started by serving on what at that point in time was a placement committee. And at that time, the fax machine was revolutionary. So we did placement the old-fashioned way, which was sending resumes and putting postage stamps on our envelopes and hearing back from them over the telephone, a landline, and things like that. So that might be an interesting opportunity, particularly because I was job searching at the time. So I started out as kind of a selfish reason, but it was something that I was really invested in. And ultimately became the chair of that placement committee and it occurred because everybody else who had more experience on the committee decided they didn't want to serve on it anymore. So by default, I was the person with the most experience. So I was given the chair position and did that for a few years. And then I started getting involved in our journal. We have a professional journal called the Journal of College and University Student Housing. I served as a reviewer on that group for probably 5 or 6 years, and then became the associate editor. There were 4 associate editors, or at the time, 3 associate editors. And then again, the people who want to be associate editors really didn't want to be the editor. And so I was the next in line to do that. So I served as the editor of the journal for about I think for about 4 years. I had the opportunity then with that work in order to apply to serve as a knowledge enhancement director for, that is an executive board position. It's a 3-year position. It's elected by your peers. I was fortunate enough to be elected into that position and serve that one for 3 years in my term. At that point in time, it's like, well, you can either, the next thing you want to do, you either get in the presidential cycle or you decide to do other volunteer opportunities. I took the chance to apply for the president role. I was selected to be on the ballot, ran, and was selected. Nobody was more surprised than I was that I actually was elected. So that's a 3-year cycle. So I was vice president in 2018, president-elect in 2019, and then the president in 2020. And now I'm the immediate past president. I don't have a role on the executive board. My only responsibility is to serve as the chair of the nominations committee, which is recruiting and selecting the next set of leaders for the executive board. So that was kind of my journey during that time. I was shoulder tapped a couple times to be able to, we helped create one of the classes that we created for students or for our staff in the area of occupancy management. I served on the National Housing Training Institute as a faculty member. I served on the Senior Housing Officer Institute as a faculty member. I was blessed to have some great experiences that kind of led me to continued involvement at Kuhawai, and it's been really a great experience.
Dr. Sanjay, your leadership certainly came at a time that the entire world have seen unprecedented times, and namely 2019, 2020. And as I'm talking to you, I was hoping that for a moment we could kind of rewind and get into the reflection mode and to hear from you what you experienced around March 14 to 2020. Were you ready for a crisis situation like COVID? Can you tell us more?
Yeah, and I would start with readiness is really a matter of perspective. Over the years, we have done a lot of planning on pandemics. I mean, with swine flu, SARS, H1N1, and all of those. And so we had a nice little binder of what we're going to, how we're going to respond to a pandemic if it occurred on our campus. But as you know, pandemics don't always follow the playbook. And right. So we have the playbook and we utilized it, but when it came to the massiveness of it and how it was impacting the entire world, we went into what normally a university does, which is assembling a critical incident management team and then looking at how they're going to respond to the increasing number of cases in the country. The critical incident management team started making the decisions regarding delaying return after spring break, the move to virtual learning, and ultimately closure of the residence halls. And those were decisions that were not necessarily in our hands. That was an important concept that the playbook doesn't necessarily say. We knew that there are times in which decisions weren't going to be made by us, but right. We did have input into it. So it's not like though I didn't sit on the critical incident management team itself, but I served on some of the subcommittees when we talked about how we're going to prepare for this, what summer camps and conferences are going to be, how we're going to open in the fall semester and things like that.
Fantastic. The field of higher education and student housing, I mean, with all the higher education institutions, each institution has at least someone who is concerned about whether on and off campus housing or off campus housing and living. What would you say were the major concerns coming from those people and how did they put an effort to resolve it? Can you tell us a little bit about that communication strategy and how you handled that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two perspectives, a university standpoint and a Kuhawai standpoint, obviously.
Right.
From our campus standpoint, I mean, we're looking at how to protect our staff. What was going to happen during the summer? What was going to happen during the spring? We returned $16 million in room and board revenue back to our students in the spring semester of 2020. We canceled summer camps and conferences, which probably would have grossed us another $5 million with revenue. The fall semester, because it was opening, we were very generous with our contract releases. And we released over 700 students because their classes were all online and didn't need to live on campus and they're trying to save money, or because they're just fearful about living in a congregate environment with COVID going on. And so that was more millions of dollars that were out there as well. So those are obviously financial concerns were important to us, but also protecting our staff and students were there as well. And I can talk about that a little bit later as well. From Kuhawai, I think our major concerns were responding to loss of revenue by campuses, summer plans, as we talked before, and how to keep staff employed doing the necessary work during times where we may not have any occupants or have very low occupancy. or in some campuses, how to lay staff off. And that was a reality. We want to make sure that we were protecting both our staff and students from the virus while right. we were continuing to work, and ultimately what occupancy would look like during the academic year. So I thought we did a really good job of responding. We did numerous straw polls to let people know, here's what's happening on the campuses, and knowing what, and we were able to break that down by large campuses, small campuses, private campuses, public colleges, and things like that. And we did a number of trackers. Our goal was to give real-time feedback on the best practices and trends that campus housing could use. And that information we gave to our housing officers in order to give to their vice presidents and presidents in order to make sure that they were making good decision-making based That's on right. data, not on what they're feeling at the time. We also created a Future of Housing work group, and it brought together housing professionals from across the country to discuss and provide options for member schools. We sponsored over 60 webinars based on various pandemic and non-pandemic related topics. And those were sort of by career level, by school size, by affinity group. So the HBCUs may figure differently than small colleges. Small colleges may look differently than large public institutions. Those that are some campuses, the University of Iowa is an auxiliary enterprise, which means we get to that our all of our income and expenses come from student rent and revenue, and none of it goes to the university. We don't get any tax dollars or anything like that. On the other hand, some of the small colleges, the money that they get from housing goes to the general university coffers. And so their loss of income was loss of income to the university and could be more detrimental to their future as an institution. Now, at the same time we respond to the pandemic, George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. I guess right. the official I could say George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis. And those many campuses responded with protests and calls for racial reckoning. And in the midst of this, Aku Hawaii wanting to provide leadership in that area, we created an anti-racism task force. And again, brought staff together from across North America. And our goal was to be able to discuss how our campuses and the association can reimagine race relations in higher education and within our own association. And we know that our history was one that while we felt like we were leaders at times, I think that we were not always leaders at the time. So that is something that we definitely wanted to look at ourselves and our policies, as well as supporting other campuses as they were going through these very difficult times. And as you know, 2020 was also an election year, and that yet another level of stress and anxiety to an already chaotic time period. So that's kind of what we're going through. But I think that some of the things that we did above and beyond just keeping our staff apprised of what's going on so they can make good decisions was an advocacy realm that we tried to work with. And we support advocacy for our staff members with higher education students and federal government, college and university campuses to utilize transferable skills that our residence hall staff had if there was ever a need to reassign them because the residence halls were closed or there was minimal occupancy. Our residence hall staff, particularly our 11 staff, are, I guess, utility knives. They're jacks of all trades, and they have a great skill set. And to be able to utilize them in other scenarios and other situations would benefit the institution. So we want to advocate for that as well. We also wrote to the governors of every U.S. state imploring them to consider prioritizing residence hall staff for vaccinations because they're essential staff and they're in close contact with students in their living spaces. And so it was important for us to be able to say that, I mean, our healthcare staff were 1A. They were the people who were the most important and needed to be vaccinated. But you know what? Our residence hall staff, our custodians, our maintenance staff, who are normally the lowest paid, were people who needed to have those vaccines. And we want to let people know that they are in congregate housing. They are cleaning their toilets. They're having interactions with students. And they needed to be able to be protected as much as our healthcare workers were. And so our goal of sending that information to governors is to implore them to prioritize. We felt that it was important to do that. I don't know where those letters went, if they sat on governor's desk or if they even made it to the governor, whether that impact was important or not. So, because we represent the largest and smallest campuses in the U.S. and around the world, there's really no boilerplate approach how we can support campuses with a single set of recommendations. So our Future of Housing Task Force or work group didn't set out recommendations, they set out guidances. And so we were able to provide a litany of different ideas that they could use, but as a one size doesn't fit all, to be able to use what works best on their respective campus. So ultimately, we provide our members options and alternatives for campuses to consider.
I mean, as you're saying this, this sounds so easy, and I really feel empowered myself. I mean, like hearing everything that has been done. And obviously, the question then arises about all of these experiences, and I'm sure there were challenges too. And if you were to kind of frame like what were maybe in your opinion two or three major challenges? I mean, again, there are millions of other challenges that you faced, but if you were to kind of summarize them into like different three categories and then say what were your lessons learned, and perhaps tapping on the question of reimagining what the future is like, what would you say are the trends that you see that everyone should be following?
That's a good question. I know that one of the biggest frustrations that we faced in higher ed overall was the uncertainty of the pandemic and the length of the pandemic and the sense of kind of loss of control that we didn't. Many of us had a seat at the table, but there are probably some campuses where their housing people didn't have seats at the table and weren't able to provide a significant amount of input regarding how they're going to respond to it. And so I think that was certainly one of the frustrations that housing professionals experienced during that time. Because of the multiple waves of the pandemic, we didn't think that fall was going to be an issue. We thought that the way that the guidance regarding how COVID spread changed throughout the early months of the pandemic, we thought it was going to be that it was by touch. And so we cleaned off everything. But then we found out that it was airborne and thought that was a game changer. We thought that it was going to, when it became summer in the United States, that the virus would die out and we'd be fine for the fall semester. And it would just, I mean, the way that things change so often, I think was really a sense of frustration. But I think our biggest obstacle, I think, for housing operations was ultimately the loss of income, whether that be to the housing operations or to the university. As I said, we refunded almost $16 million of room and meal plans the spring 2020 semester. And we were generous with contract releases for students whose classes were exclusively online in the fall semester. And that we released, as I said, we released 700 students in the fall semester with no penalty. Many said, hey, yeah, we're going to come back in the spring when the pandemic is done. Pandemic wasn't done in the spring. And so many of those students didn't come back. And I think that the length of time that the students had to deal with, particularly our first year students, because they lost their senior prom, they lost their graduation ceremonies. They lost saying goodbye to some of their friendships. They lost the interactions that that students would normally have in the residence halls. People had to wear masks. We limited, I mean, campuses limited the number of guests they could have in the residence halls. And so it was probably not the typical residential experience that their siblings may have had when they came to college. And that was hard for our students then, and taking classes virtually meant that they didn't get out of the residence hall rooms as often perhaps as they'd like. And I think we saw certainly some rebound effect with that. I have to say within our campus, our vandalism went a lot higher because I think that was the way that students were trying to, I don't know, they were trying to control the uncontrollable, and perhaps that's something they do that they did. We weren't thrilled with it. We kind of understood it, and we hope that that is an anomaly because the numbers were significantly higher than had been previously. And I know contractually we could have held students to their academic year contract. We had a binding contract with them, and we could have certainly done that. And financially, certainly that would have been the prudent move. But we also knew that our students and families were struggling with finances. They may have lost jobs. They may have seen their 401k or whatever reduced down. And so they may not have had the funds to go back to college. And so if they could save $10,000 by not living in the residence halls and not having a meal plan while they were going to classes virtually, that was the right decision. And we made the decision to let the people out of their contracts if their classes were virtual and they moved home. And we knew in the long run, we'd probably be okay financially. We'd struggle, but we'd be okay. But that decision ultimately impacted whether or not a student could continue to attend the University of Iowa in the long run. And we felt that was the more important decision because, as I said, as a large operation, we'll struggle, but we'll survive. We didn't want the students to be able to stop coming to the university or attend somewhere else because of decisions that we made. So we were pretty generous about that. And we're very appreciative that the university administration supported those decisions and that they also understood how important campus housing was on the students' experience at the university. When the CARES Act dollars came out, we got our fair share of that, probably more than our fair share of that, because they knew that we had been impacted most by the loss of funds. So that allowed us to close the gap between the money that we refunded in the spring semester, and it also allowed us to make our bond payments over these past two fiscal years, which is critically important. Our bondholders want to know that they're invested in a secure financial environment, and we're able to to do that, thanks to the federal government and the generosity of our leadership at the university as well. We anticipate this is going to take time to rebound for our historical class size. I mean, our class size this fall, we hope is somewhere going to be, we figure it's going to be larger than the fall 2020, but perhaps not as fall as, not as big as fall 2019. So we're still trying to determine what that is. And students are still trying to wait out the pandemic in order to say what our class is going to be like in the fall. What is the experience going to be like in the fall? So we're trying to get the message out saying, we believe we're going to have a normal fall semester. So come and live with us. And, but it is ultimately that loss of funding is going to impact our ability to fund renovations for our facilities over the next few years. And that is important for us because we need to make sure that our residence hall facilities are contemporary because we're competing with a lot of off-campus market who have built a lot over the course of the past few years, and they have nice amenities, and we need to be able to positively compete with that.
That's fantastic. I want to touch a little bit on what you mentioned in regards to the profit and losses. I know that more than 60% of revenue usually comes from housing and dining and auxiliary services for many institutions. And when you look at the student who's coming, usually that's also about 60% of their cost, whether that be domestic student or international. It's great to hear that the federal government, as well as other institutions were able to get some of that relief funding, and hopefully that'll create more opportunities and give that kick or the push to continue moving forward. And in doing so, looking at different stakeholders, the professionals like yourselves in the field who are actually going through this and on a day-to-day basis, trying to figure out the best way for students and institution and all the stakeholders involved, what would you say is the biggest area of opportunity at the moment and moving forward? Like, what do you see being that critical leverage that will allow us to continue surviving in the post-pandemic world as it comes to student housing, whether that's on campus or off campus?
I think the biggest opportunity for us is going to be able to get our students to have to understand what a normal residential experience looks like. I mean, I have to say that with the number of releases that we did, I mean, and the concern over congregate living and community restrooms or restrooms that they don't have their own restroom, I would guess that we probably had more students than normal flocking to the off-campus market who wanted to have the experience of living with other people, living independently, and living in a college community. Right. So I think that the off-campus market, while they, I'm sure they had their struggles, probably benefited from our limited occupancy, as many campuses reduced occupancy, and to provide them with the type of experience that we hope that they were looking for. I think that we certainly in campus housing, we spent a lot of time looking at how to protect our students. And so we had policies of regarding guests, regarding mask wearing, things like that, that I would guess that the off-campus market probably didn't have to worry about, at least in my conversations with other students saying, yeah, you walk in any apartment off campus and yeah, nobody cares if you're wearing a mask or not. And whereas we documented students if they're walking down the hallway wearing a mask. And that's because we want to protect our students. And that is our obligation. And so those are things that we had to be able to do. But I think from a standpoint of opportunity is still helping students understand that the residential experience is one that is unique. And whether they're on campus for 1 year or 4 years, that is an experience that they will remember for the rest of their life. And so sure. To get people to understand that and to not fear the campus living and to make sure that we're providing them some experiences that are going to be in person again. I think that not only did they have virtual learning, they had virtual programming and things like that. Right. So the opportunity for students to be able to say, you can walk down the hallway in the fall and hang out with your friends and we can have more than two people in a room. And that's going to be a great opportunity for them to, again, to meet their lifelong friends. And that's really what we bank on with the experience in the residence halls. The people who are going to be, who they meet in the residence halls are going to be their friends 60 years down the line. And those are the primary opportunities that we need to be able to emphasize with our incoming students and our current students. And also for our students who are living on campus this year, being able to say, yeah, we recognize that it probably wasn't what you had hoped for as far as an experience, but we also know that next year may be different. So give us a chance, live on campus for another year, and I think you'll find that your experience will be more fulfilling.
That's amazing. I was reading recently an article. It was actually a survey, I believe, through Education Dive. And I learned that in a survey last year, out of the 100 responders, 83% of college leaders like yourself confirmed that they began some sort of cooperation with third-party providers, companies, and private firms, whether that be outsourcing the dining and services or other auxiliary services or off-campus housing booking platforms. And out of that, 39% of them actually began, and so some significant. What would you say the future is like? Will you recommend for higher education folks to embrace technology, to partner up with other third-party providers to be able to gain better leverage?
Well, certainly, I think that depends on the campus and what is being offered. On our campus, we're very proud of the fact that our dining operation is self-op, that our housing operation, and that we do have a public-private partnership with grad housing on our campus. The university recently embarked on a partnership with Engie for our utilities management. And so they've taken over our steam plant and they've provided a seed money every year, I think, that comes out to millions of dollars every year that the university will be able to reinvest in faculty research, other initiatives that the university is going to do. And that seemed to work out well, at least in the early returns on that seemed to work out well for the university. There, I mean, certainly that one of the things during the pandemic is we partnered with a hotel so that if we set aside space for isolation quarantine housing,
right.
But if we ran out of that space, we had a hotel on standby to be able to do that. We also have, the University of Iowa also has a hospital, a teaching hospital. And so when students or when staff were in quarantine and isolation, they use that hotel as well. And so we jumped onto that in order to say, if we need it, can we use it? And they said, yes. Now, we never did have to use it within our housing, but it was available to us. So I think because of the impact, financial impact on many campuses, certainly they might be looking at those type of partnerships in order to see if they can infuse some money into their operations. I don't know how much with the CARES Act and the new higher education funding will impact that need to do that, but certainly I think the campus certainly could be looking at those partnerships to see if there's a way that they can raise some capital or to be able to ensure that their students' needs are being met and that they're continuing to function. But certainly that there are going to be campuses, and we already know of campuses who are going to be closing because the response to COVID, just knowing that they didn't get the number of students that they had over the past few years. And it's, while that might have occurred down the road, certainly COVID probably moved up that timeline a little bit more.
That's right. And I want to echo that because at Fourth State, we are an online marketplace for student intern housing. We've been helping over 380 different colleges and universities and schools and language schools. And the year of 2020 was somewhat skyrocket for us in terms of demand. We received a lot of inquiries from colleges of any size that you can imagine to be able to help them either to help fill their dorms or actually help their students with off-campus housing options. And we thought that it was amazing to see that because at the end of the day, higher education institutions' mission is to educate and empower and to create a curriculum that helps them develop holistically. And we heard from a lot of professionals that by outsourcing the student housing or other services, they were able to focus on creating competitive programs because everyone was trying to get into the virtual learning, the online learning, and providing the platform for students to connect and stay competitive. And I think one of the critical things that we learned there was the power of resources. And my question to you is, what resource do you recommend for professionals who are listeners of our podcast to use through or any other affiliations you're part of?
I would focus on the fact that Akuhu Hawaii just recently published their new strategic plan. And their strategic plan is really based on four core pillars of education, knowledge resources, community, and influential leadership and advocacy. And we talked a little bit about each of those, but some specific things we're doing in the area of education, including support for our live-in professionals and for our small college and universities, which may be struggling right now, but they comprise a significant portion of our membership. And we want to make sure that we're meeting their needs. And many of them are not auxiliaries. And so they support to the university is critical. And we want to make sure that we are assisting them to be the best that they can be and to provide them the resource to make them the most committed to the students and also to be committed to their institution so that they can, when somebody asks about outsourcing it, that they know that they have a good basis for why they exist. And we're also, obviously, a commitment to social justice is also an educational component. In the area of knowledge resources, we're talking about partnerships with faculty members and other researchers and topics of interest of our residence hall students. We want to make sure that we, that people know that living on campus provides some very tangible benefits. And so particularly when we're, I don't always say that we're in competition for the off-campus market because I always think that we're going to get our students because students want the experience of living on campus, but we certainly want to let them know that those experiences, those benefits don't occur in the first year, but they occur beyond that as well. And so we want to suggest that more students in their second, third, and fourth years live on campus as well. And so those are some of the things that we want to be able to do. And so we want to have some data that tells us just what are the important components of living on campus that we can share with students to help them make their decision. In our community area, we include outreach to college and universities across the world, and we are an international association. That's right. So we want to make sure that we have a focus on campuses serving underrepresented students, and as well as evaluating, expanding our committee and network and our online communities. We have a robust online community. Any one of the 17,000 people who are on our listserv can participate in that community at no cost to them. They can ask questions about what's going on their campuses, and they'll always get a response from somebody who says, here's what we're doing on our campus. You might want to consider that. And I think that has been very beneficial. And then our influential leadership and advocacy, I mean, engaging thought leaders on key issues facing higher education. I want to stay attuned to changes in federal and state laws, changes in Title IX, changes in funding. And at the same time, we're trying to contribute our perspective to those conversations as well. So we're not just listening, but we're trying to be able to inject ourselves to be able to say, here's what we believe should happen. And so we use our advocacy and we use potential lobbyists and things like that in order to get our message through to the legislators so that they're thoughtful in their decision-making regarding higher education.
Early in our conversation, you mentioned something very interesting about being a parent and moving your young teens from one place to another. I'm sure for the listeners who are parents, they would love to get a piece of your advice. What would your advice be? Is there a quote or piece of wisdom that you'd like to leave us with as we wrap up this episode?
Yeah. I mean, from the standpoint of student success, I think student success is complex. And as we talked before, I sent my daughter off to college this past year, and it has been really eye-opening for me, as well as just knowing what's going on campus as I get to connect with students. Unfortunately, as in my role, I don't get to talk with students as much as I would like. Interestingly, we recently had an external review of our wellness office. And as I said, that I oversee, as in my AVP role, I oversee student wellness. The reviewers talked with students about student success. And it's interesting to note that the students see student success as academic success.
Right.
They're in a competitive environment. They're looking for good grades so they can be admitted to medical school or law school or nursing school or pharmacy school or simply graduate school and finding the best job available. Many students see college as a competition, and they see asking for help as a weakness. While academicians are trying to get them to work in groups, they sometimes struggle in those cooperative ventures. And so what we try to do is to provide them with the resources they need in order to be successful, not only academically, but in the area of well-being. And that's where I see it in my daughter. When we tried to say that she was struggling in an area, we wanted to talk to your academic advisor, talk to your faculty members. It was a struggle for her to be able to do that because she sees that as a weakness, that talking to somebody is a weakness. And it's almost shameful for them to be able to ask for help. And I don't know. That's a struggle for me because I know as a guy, they always say, men never ask for directions when they're, I have no problem asking for directions if I'm stuck and don't know where I'm going. But as student affairs professionals, we really need to be there to reinforce that it's okay to ask for help, that it's okay to not be okay. And that's what we've been reinforcing when in the mental health area. It's okay to not be okay, that there are resources available to calm one's anxiety. And sometimes, I mean, we the word depression is thrown a lot. And sometimes depression is just sadness, and we name it as depression. And we need to be able to know that sadness is a temporary situation. That's something that we can work through. Life doesn't revolve around how many likes they get on Instagram. And I think that social media has really become a detriment to student success, not to mention the amount of time that they spend on social media, but also the anonymous garbage that is thrown on there at times that people will attack others without knowing them. They can hide behind a picture or a phrase or something like that. And I think that has been difficult for our students as well. And I think that we also want to teach them they can respectfully disagree with someone's opinion without being labeled. I mean, that's really important that we want them to be able to have dialogue, particularly with the election and things like that. People don't want to be labeled this or that simply because that they hold a different opinion. We want to respect people's opinions. You may not agree with them, but we want to be able to respect people's opinions. You can have dialogue about that and say, why do you think that way? Let's talk about that. So I think those are some of the major things. And finally, I think that for my daughter, I know that she's stronger than she thinks she is. And we just need to reinforce the fact that you are stronger than you think you are. And if you can understand that and you can try to be able to be more resilient in things, you will be quite successful in whatever you choose to do.
That's fantastic. You just empowered me to ask for help, Dr. Sanji, and I'd like to ask your help to nominate another speaker for the Education and Empowerment podcast.
Boy, there's so many good people out there. I'm trying to think about who might be. And two names popped in the mind simply because they are kind of at the forefront of my mind at the moment. Dr. T.J. Logan is the new Associate Vice President for the Residential Experience at Ohio State University. Just started the job last week. And I worked with him on the Akuhai Executive Board. Just he is... I would consider him a renaissance man because he is a person who very skilled in his job, but he's also a do-it-yourselfer and kind of, he took his house and he kind of rehabilitated his house and he did all the work himself. He is an artist. He contributed to Kauai while he was in pandemic and was working from home. He did some paintings. He had paintings of celebrities and people like that. And he sold those. He did it because it's something he wanted to do. And they were quite good. And he sold them at an auction that raised money for Akuhai. And they raised some good money for it. They were quite good. And so if you get on the Akuhai website, you might be able to see those pictures of those. That's quite, I mean, he is a master. I mean, I've never seen anyone who has as various skills and does them so well. So he'd be one I'd recommend. Somebody else that I'm thinking about, and because of the yesterday that the verdict and the Derek Chauvin trial came out.
Oh, yeah.
A friend of mine by the name of Lisa Freeman, she is our equity inclusion director for Akuhai. She is an amazing woman, and she has done some great work in the area of equity inclusion for Akuhai. And not only is she a great staff member and a great Akuhai partner, she's also a new parent, and she's done things really well. I think she's been really passionate about the area of equity inclusion. That is an area that we, as an association, we really want to work on more. And I know that this has, the trial, the murder of George Floyd and the trial has been weighing on her. And to hear the news last night, I think has been uplifting for her. I think of her a lot. I think that she is a great person in order to talk with. Certainly, if you want to talk about the area of Black Lives Matter, diversity, equity, inclusion, and areas regarding social justice, she is a great go-to person.
Thank you for your nominations. I'll definitely reach out to them. And as we close this episode, is there a base contact number for you if someone wants to get in touch with you?
Yeah, if people want to get a hold of me, my email address is von-stange@uiowa.edu. And you can, if you have the opportunity to put that in there, so it's all spelled right and things like that, would be great. But I'm happy to talk to anyone about my experience in housing, about Akuhai, about trends in higher education. Be happy to talk with people. And if they just need somebody that, as a undergraduate student, I really didn't have a lot of mentorship. And so if there's an undergraduate student out there who feels like that they would like to talk and I can help them clarify some things, I would love to be able to do that. So happy to share what knowledge I have. And certainly that I am not the end all be all of when it comes to knowledge. I think that there are some great people out there. So if they don't want to talk to me and talk to somebody else, I'm equally happy with that as well.
That's very gracious of you. Thank you so much. And on behalf of Forestay, I'd like to thank you for your time and the knowledge and the expertise, the wisdom, as well as all the different trends that you shared to help us get pumped about the future. I feel much more positive. I look forward to exploring what the future offers to us. And for the listeners out there who are listening to this episode, thank you for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Stanji, for your insights. For listeners, make sure you subscribe to our podcast on podcast.forestay.com so you never miss an episode. Episodes will also be available on Spotify and iTunes and Apple Podcasts and other channels. And once again, thanks Forestay for sponsoring this episode. If you're curious about the services that Forestay provides to higher education institutions that transforms on and off campus housing, check us out at about.forestay.com or podcast.forestay.com. And until our next show, thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Stanji.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Education and Empowerment Podcast. This show is brought to you by Forestay, a SaaS-enabled online booking marketplace for student and intern housing. Forestay provides turnkey, all-in-one, cloud-based accommodation software solutions for colleges, universities, and organizations. Learn more at offcampus.forestay.com and landlords.forestay.com.